We're going to call this meeting to order, an informational meeting on a topic that is really affecting our state of Minnesota, the highly pathogenic avian flu situation as it affects our turkeys and chickens and poultry in Minnesota. I want to thank you all for coming this morning. We pulled this meeting together rather quickly, so I really appreciate those that could make it and the committee members as well. Our committee actually is done meeting for the year, but we thought this was such an important topic. We wanted to get the experts together and allow our members to hear what is happening and what the state is doing to combat this, I guess what's been called now an epidemic in the poultry industry in Minnesota. So again, thank you all for coming. We have a full list of folks that are going to speak to us this morning, and we have to be out of here by 11:45, so we honor your time as well, and we will keep the program moving. After we do a little housekeeping order first, Chair Hamilton has established a tradition of honoring folks in the ag industry, and we have another one this morning, and we're honored to have Mr. Fredericks here with us. And to read the House resolution, I'm going to call on Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I would like to read a resolution that's in honor of Edward Frederick for his contributions to agriculture. It reads, whereas Edward Frederick grew up in Madison Lake area on a livestock and dairy farm and has spent almost his entire life in field of agriculture, and whereas he earned his baccalaureate degree with high distinction in agriculture education, receives the Caleb Dorr Senior Medal for his highest ranking member, master's degree in dairy production, and in 1957 earned the PhD degree in dairy physiology at University of Minnesota, and whereas an animal scientist at the University of Minnesota Northwest School of Agriculture in Crookston from 1958 to 1964 became superintendent of the University of Minnesota Southern School of Agriculture and experiment station in 1964, was named full professor in 1966, and later became provost, then chancellor of the University of Minnesota Waseca, serving that capacity until 1990. And whereas he has received many awards, including the WCCO Good Neighbor Award in 1990, the Merit Award of Gamma Sigma Delta in 1994, the Waseca Community Service Above Shelf Award, and a Lifetime Leadership Award of the Minnesota Rural Partners in 2002, the Minnesota FFA Hall of Fame in 2004, the Lifetime Achievement Award by the Agri News in 2005, and the Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation Distinguished Service to Agriculture in 2007. And whereas he was introduced into the Livestock Hall of Fame and received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the University of Minnesota CFANS Alumni Association in 2012 before retiring from University of Minnesota on December 31st, 2012, after 62 years of service. And whereas he served a facilitator and coordinator of the Minnesota Dairy Leaders Roundtable from 1992 to 2014 and served on the Board of Directors for Minnesota Agriculture Interpretive Center from its start in 1978 until 2014, including 14 years as Secretary Treasurer and 22 years as Chair. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration of the House of Representatives of the State of Minnesota that it congratulates and thanks Edward Frederickson for his many contributions to agriculture. And is signed by Speaker Kurt Dowd, Rules and Legislative Administration Joyce Pepin. It will be signed by Rod Hamilton, State Representative, and it's also signed by John Petersburg, State Representative. So thank you so much for your service. That was a quite lengthy list of accomplishments.
We're honored to have you here, Mr. Frederick. A few words.
Thanks very much to everyone. Sounds like an old guy that you described. I really have appreciated having a passion for agriculture and being part of it. I know many of you in this room, the people who are behind me, are also very passionate about agriculture, it's a great industry, and one that we want to keep moving forward. But I want to say thank you to the legislature for this honor. I realize that many people deserve it, and many people should have it, would get it, but I kind of recognize this kind of a symbol for some of them anyway. But I've had a chance to work through the years. So thank you very much. I do appreciate that. And one thing I just learned along the line, and that is that none of us accomplish anything in life without working together with other people. So I've had a tremendous amount of help through the years with my wife and family, with my faculty and staff, with colleagues inside and outside of the university. So I share any recognition that I get with them, because we wouldn't accomplish much without all of them. So let me just say thank you to all of you. And let me say thank you also to having this meeting here today with the Policy Committee and the Finance Committee, and talking about our great agricultural industry and our very important parts of it, the turkey and poultry industry. And we appreciate the fact that you're looking at that question and get some help in that area. So thank you very much.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. This is a joint hearing of the Finance and Policy Committees, and welcome, Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Thank you to you for calling this meeting and putting it together as well. And I'd like to also say a very special thank you to Speaker Kurt Dowd, Majority Leader Joyce Pepin. Yesterday, Chair Knobloch came in, and we visited about this various issue. Today, as you know, we were going to be hearing the agriculture finance bill and ways and means today. But with our leadership, after conversations with them, we wanted to have this hearing here today to gain a better understanding of what is going to be needed, not only immediately, but going forward as well, for the Department of Agriculture, for the Board of Animal Health. And then subsequently, we want to gain a better understanding as far as what this means to the poultry industry as well. So through the directive of our leadership, we thought it'd be better to pull that bill off of Ways and Means today, because they and all of us, we want to get it right. So we will not be hearing the ag finance bill in Ways and Means today for that very, very reason. So a big thank you once again to Speaker Dowd, Majority Leader Pepin, and Chair Knobloch for recognizing the issue that we have before us. And I'd also like to say thank you to the governor as well. I know the governor, too, is taking this very, very seriously. So, friends, the individuals that will be testifying here today, I want you to know that, speaking for everybody, you have our commitment. We are going to take this testimony very, very seriously, obviously, and be forthcoming with legislation to address this need. I'd also like to thank Representative Miller for your leadership on this. I know you had an amendment the other day that basically mimicked what the governor's proposal was. I will apologize a little bit. It got a little clumsy there in essence of time. But again, I want to thank you for that bill that you're introducing to address this issue. So we will get it right. We will get it right. So that, with that, Mr. Chairman, I do have a bill up in taxes as well. So please, if or when I miss any of the testimony, I assure you I'll go back and I will review it and study it fully. Because once again, with the commitment of our leadership and everybody on this committee, we are going to get this right and do the right thing for the poultry industry and agriculture in general. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's get the agenda moving, and we're going to call up Dr. John Clifford first. We are honored to have him here today. He is the Chief USDA Veterinarian. He has another time commitment. So, Dr. Clifford, welcome. Thanks for being here, and to identify yourself for our record, and to please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman, and thanks to the distinguished members. It's a real honor to be here today. I do not have prepared remarks because just found out actually this morning that I was going to be able to be here this morning with you. My name is Dr. John Clifford. I'm the Chief Veterinary Officer for Animal Health for the U.S. Department of Agriculture and also serve as the Deputy Administrator over Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service Veterinary Services Division. And the Veterinary Services Division of APHIS is the ones that a lot of, as well as other components of APHIS, are here in support of this effort. I've spent the last couple of days with a number of people here in the state. I've been out to a number of in the area where we've seen a number of these cases, and this is obviously a very devastating issue to a lot of producers and their families and to people that work for them. And it's something we care very much about. I know that Secretary Vilsack is very much involved in this issue and definitely wants to provide his support for this effort as well. We have about 60 people here on ground right now in Minnesota, and we'll continue this effort as long as it takes for us to be able to overcome this. This is something very unusual that we've seen, where we've seen highly pathogenic avian influenza adapt so well to the wild waterfowl that spreads internationally and now in the United States and North America. It's something that we may have to live with for several years. So I think the testimony that's going to be given here today by a number of folks is extremely important, and for USDA to be able to find all possible pathways and take whatever actions necessary to try to prevent this in the future. It will reoccur very, very likely in the fall, and it's likely to be not just Minnesota, but likely across all four flyways, and could impact poultry across the entire United States. So this is something we need to prepare for. We've got a short period of time, and we really need to devote that. And I really appreciate the tremendous effort that we've had together here with the state of Minnesota, Dr. Bill Hartman and his crew, with the University of Minnesota and their crew, and the producers and all the companies. Everybody has been tremendous in trying to address this issue. So I would be happy to answer any questions if you have of me, and I really appreciate to be able to be present with you today.
Thank you, Dr. Clifford. You have kind of can take a 30,000-foot view. Minnesota has been hit especially hard. Any explanations or reason why this seems to be the epicenter of the outbreak?
I would say a couple of possibilities are the high susceptibility of turkeys themselves, and the fact that what's the state's many lakes. You have a lot of waterfowl here, and I think that presents a lot of risk.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Dr. Clifford. I had a question on do you have an assessment of where USDA is on the kind of funding from the federal level that this will require? Obviously, this is a huge, more than just a state problem, but do we need to be talking to our folks that fund Secretary Vilsack on this issue?
We've talked.
Dr. Clifford, go ahead.
We have talked to Secretary Vilsack, and he has requested emergency funding. We actually got initially an appropriation of $15 million for the effort here in Minnesota. Those dollars are becoming very small now because of the number of cases we've seen, but he is definitely on top of this and requesting emergency funding. We have a process for this type of situation within the Department of Agriculture that gives the Secretary authority to request emergency funding for these types of events. So he is definitely on top of it. I know that he very much appreciates the support of the state, and I believe that we'll see additional funding coming.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Clifford, again, thank you to you and everybody as well for focusing on this. And like you'd said, we're all in this together. And also, thank you for recognizing we have tremendous, whether it's the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the Board of Animal Health, highly professional individuals that are addressing this. So thank you for pointing that out as well. And members, I see that we also have Senator Sparks here. I'm not sure if I mentioned that in the opening comments, but I want to thank the Senate and their leadership on this, and I just can't emphasize enough that you have our full support. So, Doctor, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you all very much.
Further questions for Dr. Clifford?
Thank you.
If not, thank you very much, Doctor. Next up, Ag Commissioner Fredrickson is going to be a little bit late this morning. He will be here. Let's call on Dr. Carol Cardona next up to give us some information on the disease itself. Good morning, Doctor. Welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to come and tell you a little bit about this virus and the biology, the things we know about the virus and what it's doing in turkeys.
Could you just identify yourself for the record, please?
I'm Carol Cardona. I'm the Pomeroy Chair at the University of Minnesota, a professor.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So I'm going to use a PowerPoint here. So first, to understand what we're dealing with, we have to know a little bit about this virus. We know, you hear the term highly pathogenic H5 Eurasian avian influenza virus. We know that this pathogenicity issue is one that's complicated, but it means basically that it kills turkeys and chickens dead completely. It's extremely virulent for those species. When we talk about Eurasian, that tells about where it's from. And when we talk about the H5, that simply is an identifier that we use scientifically to understand it. So what's important about this and why this is a new situation and something that is not our usual influenzas that circulate here is that this virus originated sometime in late fall in 2014 in China and in Asia, where H5 viruses of this type have been circulating for many years. This is a newly evolved virus that has gained abilities that we are learning about on an international scientific scale that are not previously known and never ever seen before. So this virus came across, we think, then into Southeast Asia, infecting many flocks, causing outbreaks in Japan and Korea. It then went north to the Trans-Siberian area, where wild birds then carried it into Germany. It caused an outbreak there. We learned about an outbreak similar to what we're seeing here in Minnesota in the Netherlands back in September of 2014, and then across it came across the Bering Sea from that original Trans-Siberian movement and down the Alaska coast, we think. We don't have evidence, but that seems the most likely way. It caused an outbreak in British Columbia affecting turkeys and chickens. Then reassortance or remixtures of this virus appeared in wild and domestic birds in Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, Utah. A commercial turkey flock in California was the first commercial flock infected with a close relative, this H5N8. Then commercial turkey or commercial ducks and chickens in California, Kings County. And now it's appearing here in our flyway or our region. So if we look at the locations of those outbreaks, the California outbreaks were the first, or the cases were the first. And I'm going to say that these have been cases. So we've heard talk of an epidemic. An epidemic would imply that this virus is spreading from flock to flock. It very much looks like most of these are cases, so that we're seeing a tremendous effort being put into control, and that appears to be working very well. Even the barns next door are not being infected, so it seems to be stopping in its track, but these cases continue to happen. So as we see, Missouri was next. We had a case, an unusual case in early March in Pope County, and then we saw cases in Arkansas and Missouri. Then it's moved back into our area, as you are all aware, with a vengeance, with many, many cases, South Dakota, North Dakota, a case in Wisconsin, now another case in Wisconsin, and perhaps in Iowa as well. So I'm going to concentrate on this area, our area of most interest. So if we look at our state of Minnesota, that Pope County case was quite early, followed by subsequent cases in a widespread, widely diverse area. These cases have been distant by up to 100 miles. This region that's affected is approximately 300 miles apart. So North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and of course our beloved Minnesota. We look at the cases and when they've occurred. This disease we've learned from the people at the Southeast Poultry Lab, which is one of our premier USDA labs, premier influenza lab in the world, and we're grateful to USDA that they've maintained that laboratory as a national resource. We've learned from them that this disease has a very long incubation period, so the infection may be occurring quite a long time before we see the actual cases diagnosed. And so based on that, we're looking at introductions that have taken place over a period of time, the majority of which appear to have been so far between March 28th and April 3rd. That's where we saw the majority of the cases so far introduced. That could change as we see the continuing trickle in of cases as they become evident. This is not a disease we can live with. This is not a disease we can live with and have a sustainable and globally competitive poultry industry. This is not just a disease of turkeys. This can also become adapted and learn to grow, as you, if you will, in chickens. In addition, this scene is devastating. You can imagine a turkey producer who has worked his whole life to build a farm and keep do his best, eking out the last penny per pound of production, to come into this. It's absolutely horrific. And I think our hearts have to go out to those farmers who are dealing with this, their families, their communities. This is horrific. So the question I'm asked all the time in the media is, are we done yet? And we don't know. When we look back at this epidemic curve, we sort of have a trailing edge of about 8 days. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that the sunshine that we see today, the warm weather, is all leading to the end of this wave. But as Dr. Clifford has told us, and we've learned this from our folks at Southeast Poultry and another national lab, or another national research group, the Center for Epidemiology and Animal Health in Fort Collins, that this is likely to be a fall and spring type thing here in our state. And we can expect to see it for at least the next 3 to 5 years. So this is unprecedented. This is a virus we've never seen before. Even in the days when turkeys were on range, we never saw this many cases introduced in our state. So there's something very, very strange here and very, very devastating. The other thing I'd like to add is this idea that we have a lot of control zones. So 300 miles diameter circle of this area. That means the resources that Dr. Clifford and the Board of Animal Health and others have put into helping us to keep that virus from spreading are spread across approximately a 3,000 square mile area. We are being taxed to the limit. And we appreciate very much their efforts on the behalf of our turkey production and of our state. And so that's all I have today.
Thank you, Doctor. Questions? First is Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are there any wild birds that are susceptible to this type of avian flu?
There are. Experimentally, very few wild birds, and of course, since this virus is new to North America, we're all learning as we go. But several wild bird species have been infected, I believe widgeons and teal and some other types of ducks. Experimentally, the Southeast Poultry Group has infected mallard ducks and found them to be easily infected and that they spread the virus easily to contacts. It appears that some species of wild birds show very limited clinical signs and are quite healthy when infected. But we also know that there's, worldwide there's 9,000 avian species, and many of them react differently to different viruses, just like we react differently to a virus than a dog would. That said, for example, raptors have been, some of them have been very severely affected, so great horned owls and falcons, deer falcons. We also know that the Canada goose looks like they may also show signs when infected.
More question, Matt.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what can we do in the future to prevent this from happening again? Is there a way that we need to change how we produce turkeys and chickens in Minnesota, and do you have suggestions?
Right. So I think that's a really great observation, and I would completely agree with that. I think we're looking at a situation that has changed overnight, but that, you know, we're no longer living in the world we were, and we no longer have and the world that we developed this production system around. So I think you're right. We have to look to developing biosecurity strategies that can help to address these issues.
Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Doctor, I think I picked it up. This is not transmitted via aerosol, right? This is a direct contact, whether it's with fecal matter or direct contact with birds who actually have the virus, or can it be transmitted through the air?
Well, it's a complicated issue, of course, and the reality of what we live with in the field can be very different from what we see in experimental studies. So I would say that it's likely not to be transmitted by aerosol. Aerosol means very small particles that float in the air, the particles that, if I sneeze, they would make it to you. However, we could be looking at airborne transmission. So strong winds, for example, can carry viruses short distances on feathers, in small particles of fecal material. So we're struggling to understand all of the potential ways that this could be moving from the reservoir onto farms, into barns, all of that kind of thing requires a tremendous amount of epidemiologic examination and retrospective study. So it's hard to do on the fly.
Right. Thank you.
Chair Hamilton.
And Doctor, you also talked about this originated in China and Asia. Do we know what the impact has been as far as the percentage of flocks over there that have been infected, and or the negative economic impact that it's had on other countries?
Well, it's really hard to say, because not all countries have the infrastructure that we do, both for surveillance and, you know, Dr. Clifford could tell you how many tests we do in this country, but it's in excess of what other countries do. And in addition to the lack of surveillance, there's not always the transparency that we provide to the rest of the world. We tell people what we're doing. We tell them what we're seeing. We tell them about negative tests, and we tell them about positive tests. That allows people to understand things like prevalence and incidence, and understand how things might be moving. Not all countries report to us that way. And many countries do use vaccine, which does interfere with our ability to know the questions you're asking.
Chair Hamilton.
And just thank you, Doctor, for all that you do. Greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to thank the doctor. Oops, I have a quick question for the doctor.
Doctor, you're not done yet.
Sorry. Oh, my goodness.
Actually, I represent Kennewick County, and I've been visiting with our friends at Genio Turkey, and they are really proud and grateful you are on the ground. And talking with them yesterday, just really feel confident that the right team is on the ground. And again, they've mentioned you several times, so thank you so much for your service. My question would be, are we seeing different age groups of birds being affected more or less than others? Is it mature birds? Are they young birds? Is it anything? I'm just kind of curious about the maturity of the birds and your thoughts on that.
Doctor.
Well, so we do indeed see an age group sort of predilection, if you will. And right now, you know, we're still in the process of analyzing all the data. Like I said, these things are always better looking backwards than trying to look in the heat of battle. But it does look like indeed, birds around 16 weeks of age or so.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I'm wondering what kind of advice how are farmers handling this to try to avoid it? What advice are you giving them to try and keep their barns secure? And, you know, there's a lot of things that come in and out of a farm. Right. So how do you deal with that?
Doctor?
So, you know, we in extension world and in university land have always dealt with a system where we've said you need to protect yourself from your neighbor because that's the most likely source of something that's bad for your birds. And today we're shifting that message to say you need to concentrate on that barn unit. What's outside your barn is what your greatest threat is. So we're working on things like the Danish bench system for barns. Dr. Sally Knoll at the University College of Food and Animal Science at CFANS is working on helping to spread the word about the Danish bench system, where you come into a barn, your outside barn boots, your outside boots stay on one side of the bench. You swing your legs over and put on new boots to protect those birds from anything that could be carried on your boots. So things like that are being implemented, and it's very hard to, of course, switch on a dime. But we're shifting that message from inside the barn outside to an inside the barn outside the barn clean and dirty system.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, you know, I grew up on a farm and I'm a farmer's wife, but I. We don't have animals. My brother does and has lost a whole barn of hogs to a disease long, long ago. They were able to stay away from this latest hog disease. But I know that you have a lot of trucks traveling, you know, feed goes back and forth. Right. And so does this bench system then alleviate that problem too? I know we're trying to think about how trucks are washed and
right.
and where and those kinds of things.
So it's important to look at the most likely source of, you know, infectious material. So a lot of times we try to look at all the activities that take place on a farm and we say, what's the pathway to get into the barn, into the birds? And so we've looked a lot at feed trucks, and right now we're proposing to do some studies to look at parking feed trucks on facilities and collecting swabs to see on infected facilities to see what the potential contamination is. But that said, a feed truck spends a very little amount of time on a farm, and so the real risk, we think, is that driver. So what we're doing is we're doing biosecurity around the driver. The driver stays in the truck as much as possible. The driver never enters the barn, ever. The driver reboots. They use the paper floor mats, you know, to keep any contamination from moving from farm to farm. Many farms are using a feed truck system where they bring the feed truck to the gate. They load the feed into a smaller truck that's specific to the farm. That truck then feeds the bins and stays on the farm. So there's a number of ways to get around those things. But the key is to look at all the activities and then prioritize effort to those most likely to result in an introduction. In other words, since we don't know how this is happening, anything that gets near the birds is at the top of that list.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Doctor, you had mentioned that this was going to be something that may come back in the fall, in the spring, and for the next 3 to 5 years. Is that because of the migratory patterns of the birds that carry that? And then does temperature or anything, I mean, why the fall and the spring and why 3 to 5 years?
Well, you know, I leave it to the experts to in the DNR to help us explain the migratory cycles and things. It's really not my area. But in terms of our domestic turkey production, we know that the fall and the spring are times of year that we see cases of influenza, not this kind, but other types that, you know, are infrequently introduced into those turkey farms. So we have a system, and we have for 40 years in the state, to take care of those low path viruses. Because this is something new, this is speculation. But following the predictable patterns of the past, we would say that the spring and the fall. Why that is, the fall has always been associated with juvenile birds being hatched, coming together in large groups. And so in terms of a transmission cycle, there's a lot of naive hosts that come together, and so, or birds that haven't been exposed to the virus before, they get that virus, expand it, and then it's available to move into those turkey populations.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony. And to what degree has it affected the chicken population in our state? I was noticing the map, and I've got a huge chicken producer in my district in Sibley County, Crystal Farms. And I just noticed the dots went all the way around it.
Right.
And but I mean, has it seems like most of the reporting has been on turkey, but to what degree has it affected the chicken industry?
That's a great question. And again, I go back to our friends at the Southeast Poultry Lab. What they have shown us experimentally is that infecting chickens were susceptible to infection, but when they put naive chickens or chickens without antibodies, no protection, in the cage with them, they didn't get infected. So they didn't spread the virus. Now, this is influenza, so things change every day with this darn virus. So will it affect them someday? Maybe. How it is affecting our chicken producers is that they are on high alert, sweating bullets. I doubt that many of them are sleeping. They're very, very concerned. They're in this fight together with the turkey industry, and although it's affecting turkeys right now, they know it will affect them as well.
Doctor, thank you so much for your expertise on behalf of all of us here today. We really appreciate the work being done. One last question. You say you and the folks working on this are taxed to the limit. What more do you need? What more can we do to help you in this fight?
Well, I think those of us in the university, we're looking to support through places like the Mid-Central Research and Outreach Center, where we have a laboratory that's working to support the research that's being carried out by personnel in the field, so by industry folks who are asking questions and need answers. That's an essential piece of this. How I think, to the questions previously, how do we build production for the future? That's an important question that needs to be answered, I think, this summer. We have a brief period of time to get this done. And so what resources do we need? I think we've got great teams on the ground. I think we've got the ability to handle research questions. I think we're looking at research funding through mechanisms like the Rapid Ag Response Fund. And I think my colleagues at USDA and the Board of Animal Health can speak to the resources that they will need to handle this other piece, which is control and regulation.
Thank you very much. I don't see any more questions. Thank you again, Doctor. Commissioner Dave Fredrickson, welcome down. Thank you for taking time this morning to give us an update and maybe a bit of somewhat okay news today. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Well, thank you very much. I'm Dave Fredrickson, Commissioner of Agriculture. Representative Anderson, thank you for holding this hearing. It's an important issue that we've been struggling with for the last, I don't know, five, six weeks, I guess. I've been looking to my colleague, Dr. Hartman. Where to begin with this whole issue? First of all, my compliments to the Board of Animal Health for their work. As you may or may not know, the Department of Agriculture is, we are supportive in this effort. The lead agency is indeed the Board of Animal Health and have been doing an excellent job. We're there to support them. The Emergency Operations Center is now located at the Department of Agriculture, right off the atrium. As you come into the Freeman Building, it's a very active site at this point in time. We have something over 60 And I missed Dr. Clifford's discussion, but I assume that he indicated the number of folks that have been here from Washington and other states around the country. I think we have folks from several states, including Puerto Rico, that are employees of USDA APHIS, Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. And so without that federal partnership right now, we would be doing our work, but we would be struggling some, I think, across the state. So we're so appreciative of that. Obviously, the resources that are being poured into Minnesota to handle the indemnity issue are huge. Something in excess of $15 million have gone to those flock owners at this point in time. And again, they're here with the indemnity. They're also here with people. And they're also here to cover our regular work day if our time is committed to that effort. So I can't say enough about our federal partners in this effort. We have in excess, I'm guessing, and again, I'm guessing we were pushing a million birds that have either died of the influenza or have been, the kind word, I guess, is depopulated, but that means killed. Of course, the process by which that takes place is a foamer. I think Dr. Hartman indicated we have nine foamers on the ground. Right now, they'll move into a facility, raise the level of foam. The birds are euthanized by that process. They are then composted in the building over a period of weeks. The temperature, I believe, is to increase to, I believe, is it 140 in the compost pile. It is then broken down again, and then they recompost it. And by the time that that compost process is complete, it's something similar to large chunks of dirt. It can be then moved out. The issue of why it's here during the summer or the winter and fall and spring has to do with temperature, I'm told. Now, I'm an old dirt farmer from Murdoch, Representative Miller, and so I don't understand the science, but I can repeat what I've been told. And the science is that the virus doesn't survive in temperatures beyond 80 degrees. And so, of course, we have 80-degree temperatures, Representative Marquardt, during the summer. Maybe not where you live. It's kind of up, but in the banana belt down here, we occasionally hit, well, yes, right, Representative Fabian, you wouldn't know what 70 looks like up there, would you? So that's the good news, but then, of course, it comes back to hit us again in the fall and certainly in the spring during that migratory process. It started on the West Coast, in the Pacific Flyway, and has gradually moved to the east. I know that we have five epidemiologists that are working diligently trying to understand how this virus gets into the barns. I think they're looking at everything from feed to bedding to just the biosecurity around a facility. But it, you know, as Representative Fabian knows, it knows no boundaries. I mean, we've had from Roseau County to the southern border of Minnesota and from the South Dakota border all the way through west central Minnesota. And, of course, Representative Anderson, you had the dubious distinction of having the first case. And we learned something from that. This is it's very interesting because this is in real time a incredible experience for all of us that are involved in this process, and we have been practicing for this. We've looked to the future in that we knew something was going to come at us at some point in time, and so I think we can, and you all can be extremely proud of the response effort that the Board of Animal Health has put forward with our partners from the DNR and certainly our partners from the Board of Health. And so we've all worked very well together. And it's always interesting, you know, when you have local folks, and Steve Olson is here representing the growers for them to work with the Board of Animal Health, to work with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, to work with the state legislature, and then to also work with our federal partners without having a fist fight is pretty incredible. And I'm really, really proud of that networking and the strong relationship that they all have had. Why don't I just stop there, and I'll be happy to take any and all questions that that you might have on the issue.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Fredrickson, first of all, I can't thank you enough for the leadership that you've taken on this. The Board of Animal Health, I was writing down your list, and there's so, as you kind of stole my thunder on that part, but the USDA, the DNR, the growers, everyone's working really hard. This is very important to me because this is my district that's being affected greatly, but this is important for the state of Minnesota. This is important for the United States. So I can't thank everyone that's participated in this enough. This is a very important thing, and it's tragic. Dr. Cardona, I'd also like to thank the work that she's doing out at the Mid-Central Research and Outreach Center is fantastic also. So two quick questions. Have you been able to gather together what the economic impact of this has been or what it might be, or do you have any numbers? That's my first question. Do you have any numbers that might address what the economic impact for Minnesota might be at this point?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman and Representative Miller, I think that answer would come more likely from Steve Olson, okay, who is on the ground and representing the growers across the state. But rest assured, members that and Representative Miller, that it is a huge economic impact, particularly from the export perspective. It is also an economic loss to those growers because they're going to lose that cycle. It's a good, probably a six-month, I'm told, cycle where from the time that birds are diagnosed with H5N2 to the time that they can get back in the swing of things, you're going to lose, 4 to 6 months. And when you get out of that cycle, obviously everything starts from the shackle and backs all the way up, but because you have to keep that plant in your districts running full time. And so from a trade perspective, our large trade, China, Mexico, and other countries are trade partners in this. China has basically said no to all products from the United States, and it probably is a trade barrier as opposed to a phytosanitary issue. I'll let the folks in Washington, D.C., figure that one out. We continue to work to get our name off those lists. Mexico is a large trade partner. I believe the number is something close to 64% of the product that leaves Minnesota goes to that country, and they are working with us on that to have, instead of a full ban, a partial ban. And so our friends at APHIS, Dr. Clifford has been in contact with our trade partners, and that's where that emphasis is put. I think it's, Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's in excess of 120 or more millions of dollars on an annual basis that goes out the door to our trade partners across the globe. And so it is it's a huge number. And then, of course, the indemnity doesn't make those owners of those barns whole. It helps. It's similar to the livestock indemnity program that was part of the Farm Bill. That, by the way, is not directed toward disease. That federal program is only directed to weather-related sites. So we can't look to the LIP program or livestock indemnity program to assist us in that. So the only money that is available, obviously, is through the Department of Ag, through the Secretary's discretionary authority to access Commodity Credit Corporation funds. I'm told by Dr. Clifford and others that stream of money is there. It should not be a problem. So those dollars will indeed assist, but it won't make them whole.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you actually answered my second question as to how the markets are reacting, but I just want to punctuate it, and perhaps Mr. Olson can expand on this. I've talked to some people in the industry in my area, and they have said that the current loss of flocks is definitely devastating. but their real concern is the markets and the future markets of what impact this is going to have with our product it's going to be impacted in years. So you answered it already so eloquently, but I thank you for mentioning that we have not only what we're losing with birds right now, but this is an industry that's going to be impacted for probably at least what you're saying up to 5 years, I think I heard, is what we might be looking at. So hopefully we address those issues as well in the future.
Unless Mr. Chairman and Representative Miller of the University of Minnesota comes up with some magical elixir to take care of this problem, we can only hope.
Representative Bly.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Over here. Following on that line of questioning, I also am concerned about domestic sales of turkey and what might be done to reassure consumers that turkey that makes it to the market is okay or safe to buy. I noticed when I went to the grocery store last night that the ground turkey area was still pretty full. Usually it's half empty or whatever, and it concerns me that we're going to see a back off in purchasing of turkey domestically as well.
I assume those bags are full of turkey sandwiches. Absolutely, and we've been very, very careful at the department, at the Board of Animal Health, and certainly at the industry level to continue to reassure consumers that this is not a problem, that a bird that has H5N2 will never, ever enter the food chain. And so we continue to talk that up all across the state every chance we get. Other states, you know, many of the products in the industry leave the state borders. Some of it goes out externally to other countries, but much of it is moved across the 50 states or 49 states. One of the states, Arkansas, has talked about a ban or has put one on, and we're actively seeking them to take a second look at that. We've been in contact with their folks, their governor's office, and others to have them stop and think about that and the effect that is going to have on the industry as a whole. So we continue to be vigilant. We continue to watch that. We continue to work with the grower organizations to bring the right message to our friends in other states. Arkansas is one of them that we're focused on presently, and I'm sure there will be others that will blink, but we want to stay on top of it.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Commissioner Fredrickson, for coming down here today. I just want to shift the conversation to the hatcheries and what they are doing to secure themselves, and with the flu, how will they be able to keep up with the demand?
Commissioner.
Well,
we may want to.
We may, you know, it would be a good time to have Representative Olson, of course, Executive Director Olson, and also Dr. Hartman, because so many of these questions could be answered by a team of folks up here. I am a mile wide and maybe a few inches deep on all areas, but we need to go deeper in these. And as far as that, Representative Franzen, I don't know if there's some.
Mr. Olson, would you care to come up? Or Dr. Hartman?
Yeah,
come on up. We also have a couple of producers that have come today, so we want to get to those as well. So bear that in mind. We have to be done in about a half an hour. Questions pertaining to the hatcheries and the eggs, Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. To answer that question, I'm going deep into my presentation, but that's all right. I'll do it out of order. So when we find one of these affected flocks, what we have to do is draw a 10-kilometer circle around it, and that's called the control area. And in that area, frequently now we've been finding hatcheries, we've been finding processing plants, we've been finding feed mills, and everything that has poultry in that area has to be quarantined, and so they can't move anything. And so luckily, we've been working with USDA over the last 5 years or so, well, it's probably more like 10 years, in developing a continuity of business plan so that we can find a way to permit Dale poults out of these hatcheries safely so that they can go and replenish the supply. So we're working very hard to permit all of these activities that go on in these control zones, and the activities are, there's a lot of activity, and it's keeping us extremely busy just doing the permitting process.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Hartman. I want to be kind of a little bit more on the control zone, the 10 kilometer. Is that a radius, or is that?
Doctor?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, yes, that is a 10-kilometer radius.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just hypothetically, let's say that my turkey flock is, has got this, and you're doing the depopulation and so forth, and Mr. Olson is 5 kilometers down the road, and his birds are ready to go to market. You said nothing is moving in that area. Would that mean those birds as well?
Doctor?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, that's the permitting process that we have in place. So not only does it apply to Dale poults, but it also applies to market weight turkeys. So they would have to be tested before they went to market, but then they could go, yes.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just how extensive is that testing then? I mean, if there's 10,000 birds there, they're ready to go to market.
Doctor?
That's a daunting task.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, we test a certain percentage of the birds that are in the flock so that we're certain that the virus isn't present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Hartman.
Dr. Hartman, carry on.
Okay, well, thank you for having me here today. I appreciate the opportunity to update you on our response to this disease. And as the Commissioner said, this is not just the Board of Animal Health doing that. And I'm happy for that because it would be a daunting job to try and do by ourselves. Yesterday we confirmed 8 more infected farms, and so as Dr. Cardona said, that brings us to a total of 22. And if you look at those control areas, that's a very, very large area in Minnesota. So there's a lot of people working. I think there are about 150 people working now on this process. And it's turned into a big job. We do expect more cases of the disease, so we don't think we're done yet. And so it's good to be aware of the fact that this is ongoing. Prior to March, we had never seen this disease in Minnesota before. We've seen a lot of low pathogenic avian influenza, which doesn't kill the birds, but we hadn't seen highly pathogenic avian influenza. And that picture that Dr. Cardona showed you of the barn full of dead turkeys, that is being repeated in Minnesota over and over and over again. So we're very concerned. This is a foreign animal disease, and because of that, we have to act rapidly and make sure that we're not allowing the virus to spread, and we've had good success with that so far. Because of the number of farms that are affected and these zones that we're talking about around, the workload has become enormous, and I want to thank the commissioner for all of his help. He's donated a lot of employees to this effort, and we surely need them. I just briefly want to describe to you what happens when we find an infected farm. We have to immediately quarantine that farm. We have to collect, well, first thing that we get is we get a report from a producer that they have an unusual death loss in their flock. They call us. We quickly get samples to our veterinary diagnostic lab so that we can test them there. And it's very important that we do that quickly because the birds are dying and the owner will only get compensated for live birds. So the longer it takes for us to get that diagnosis, the less money the owner's going to get. So it's very important. We then quarantine the flock. We go in and, as the commissioner said, we do the depopulation and the composting. And then we draw these 10 and 20 kilometer circles around. And I mentioned to you what we do in the 10-kilometer area, but in the 10 kilometers beyond that, we also have to contact all the people with poultry in the area to make sure they're aware of what's going on and to report any unusual death loss to us from that area as well. USDA has brought people in who have expertise in incident command, biosecurity, epidemiology, and composting so that we can make sure that we're doing this in the best way possible. I was on a conference call yesterday with Dr. Mike Osterholm from the University of Minnesota, Dr. Scott Wells from the university, and Dr. Brian McCluskey, who's the chief epidemiology officer for USDA. And they're discussing a project they want to get started as quickly as possible, and that is to do a case control study. So they want to look at farms that are getting affected and then farms that aren't getting affected in very great detail to try and understand what are the risk factors for this disease so that we can let the poultry owners know and they can implement some of the things that might be protecting some of these flocks. So that's in process. As has been mentioned before, we're not in this alone. The Department of Health is involved because they're monitoring the health of the workers on the farms. And the good news is nobody's gotten sick yet from this virus, so that's a good thing. We're also partnering with the Department of Natural Resources because, as you heard before, the influenza viruses are carried by ducks and geese. We don't know for sure yet that this virus is in our ducks and geese because DNR has done a little bit of sampling and they haven't found it yet. But they're going to continue to do that sampling. Governor Dayton has been very involved in this, and he has assured me any help that we need, he would be happy to contribute. So he's gotten us the resources that we've needed to deal with it. As a matter of fact, he and Lieutenant Governor Smith held a conference call with the poultry industry to offer any help they could and to ask the question, how could they help? So I just would finish by saying we've been planning for this for the 14 years I've been in this job. We were ready for it, and we've been successful in dealing with the affected farms as we found them. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Doctor. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Hartman, I want to follow up on the vectors or mode of transmission. And, you know, in our business, we get a lot now with social media. Sometimes rumors pop up, and I just want to give you a chance to maybe answer a couple of those. One is, is the highly pathogenic avian influenza transmitted or carried in cats? In cats.
Doctor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, no.
Okay. Representative?
Mr. Chair, and Dr. Hartman, with the virus, is feed a potential method of transmission? Is there a chance that there could be turkey fecal matter in feed or body parts, body fluids from poultry that is in the feed that could transmit the virus?
Doctor?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, that's something that this group of epidemiologists is going to be looking at, and we're going to be testing feed. One of the things that I saw was yesterday was a picture of a corn pile. This is from a while ago, and it was associated with porcine epidemic diarrhea and why these pigs were getting infected. But it was in South Dakota, it wasn't in Minnesota. But on that corn pile that was next to an elevator, there were about 200 geese on top of it. And the next week they took a picture of it. The geese were gone, but the goose poop was there. So It's something we surely want to be looking into.
Representative Hansen.
And then, Mr. Chair, finally, I want to go to the composting question because, you know, back when I worked at the Department of Ag, I know we had some demonstration projects with composting, and there was discussion about heat that's involved. But we're dealing with a large scale now of biomass that we're having to deal with. So are you assured that with composting that the temperature in the compost will get high enough, quickly enough, to kill the virus? Or, I mean, I've had people ask, why aren't we incinerating the dead birds versus composting them? And I realize there's difficulty with transport there. So maybe just a little bit on the composting and the assurance of destruction of the virus in compost.
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, we're being extremely careful with this. So the science behind it is that composting to 140 degrees twice will kill the virus. But then we're being extra precautious before we allow that compost material to be spread on fields. It will be tested. So they're going to be taking environmental samples from the compost pile to make sure that there's no virus present.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Hartman and Commissioner Fredrickson. May want to have a follow-up on the feed issue. Dr. Cordona, did you have something to say about the feed issue?
Yes, thank you. The feed that is given to turkeys is we have two major ways to treat the feed before it goes to the farm. So in the feed milling process, the feed is pelleted, and there's a number that is a heat treatment process, which would far exceed the lethal temperature for the virus. So that would kill the virus. The second way that the virus is handled is if the turkeys are fed a mash feed, so non-pelleted feed. It's treated with a disinfectant that would kill the virus in the feed, but is not. It's fine for the turkeys to consume.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Bly had a question.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Cardona, before you leave, you may not be able to answer this, but you mentioned some common denominators in the age of the turkeys, for instance. Are there others that might provide precautionary information to other turkey growers that you've noticed from the various farms?
Our USDA and Board of Animal Health partners, Dr. Hartman is being extremely modest here to say that the studies that are ongoing are coming, because they're ongoing. They are happening right now, and as they find something that might be biologically dangerous and could be considered a high priority, they're communicating that the industry is changing those risk factors. So as we go along here, there's a number of risk factors that were present in the early cases that are no longer present because they've been fixed. So I'll give you an example of that. The first case that happened in California, we immediately arranged for a communication between the flock veterinarian and veterinarians here in Minnesota that work with turkey farms. And he communicated that I think the most likely thing that happened was that there was a pond at the end of the barn and about 100 yards, and then we brought the tractor in to till the litter on the older birds, and we probably drove through duck feces. Okay, so immediately our turkey companies stopped the movement of equipment between barns. So we know that was a risk factor, but it's gone now. So to answer your question, we're kind of doing this in real time. So as they come up, sure, they get changed.
Thank you, Doctor. Let's have our producers. I believe we have John Zimmerman and Pete. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
For Dr. Hartman, I'm sorry to. You mentioned that there haven't been any human-to-human infections in the current case. in the history of the influenza, are you aware of any transfer from human to human as this disease has progressed over time?
Human to human. Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'll defer that question to somebody from the Health Department.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning. My name is Chris Ayersman. I'm the Director for Infectious Disease at the Department of Health. And, yes, we do have evidence of, you know, avian influenza being transmitted to humans, and that's in part why we are monitoring the poultry workers for 10 days after their last exposure, just to make sure that we don't see that transmission. But I think it's important to keep in mind that in these situations, it's limited transmission. So in other words, it's we don't see widespread person-to-person transmission. Rather, it's an individual who's had direct contact mm-hmm. with poultry. But we do monitor that because I think, as you're aware, influenza is definitely a wily virus. And so the concern is you don't want mixing of avian influenza strains with human influenza, with other influenza strains to have, you know, changes in the virus. But at this point, you know, yes, there's potential for transmission from birds to people. We haven't seen it thus far with this situation.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quick. And maybe this is a Dr. Hartman, but maybe the infectious disease as well. I know in Wisconsin they had done some monitoring of groundwater for viruses, not the avian virus, but what is the research, or, you know, I'm concerned about water transfer. So if we look at vectors and temperature, have you looked at water monitoring for virus or source water for the virus staying alive?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Hansen.
Sorry. Actually, we're in the process of conducting a water virus study right now. We were funded through the Clean Water Legacy, and so we will be looking at that, but it's just in the early stages, so it's too early to be able to provide you with any information on that right now. But we do have a virus study looking at groundwater that's currently in process.
Thank you. And could we get your name again, ma'am? My hearing is not as good as it used to be.
No, that's fine. My name is Chris Ayersman, Director for Infectious Disease at the Department of Health.
Thank you, ma'am. Is John here and Pete, a couple of producers who could come up and join Mr. Olson? Mr. Olson, good morning, and Mr. Zimmerman, also good morning to you. And could you share us what's happening out there?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Olson. I'm the executive director with the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. Pete was not able to make it this morning as well. What I have some comments that that are going to be based on relationship, but also based on investment, and the investment that the state legislature and the governor have made, you know, your predecessors, but also what you have done in the last couple of years, that has made a huge difference in how we are handling this situation and the success that we are having with this situation. And I do want to say that we are having success with this because we are controlling it on each of these farms. This is not a farm-to-farm or a barn-to-barn spread, as you've heard from previous speakers. And the comments I have are comments that actually I had at a press conference that the governor pulled together earlier this week, and I'm using these for two reasons. One is that I think that they both, it's information that's applicable to you. It's an overview, but it's information that's applicable to you. And then also my computer froze up on Monday night, so of all things to happen during this time. So the I have to tell you, I have to admit that I wish I weren't here. Normally this time of year, our office would be wrapping up. Our convention was held last month, and we would be wrapping up from that. We would be excitedly talking about the Wilds playoff game tonight, and we would also be tracking legislation that all changed about 6 weeks ago when high-path avian influenza came to our state. And while I wish neither I nor high-path avian influenza were here, I and the poultry farmers and processors of Minnesota are thankful for the coordinated response of the state and federal animal health animal and human health efforts. This truly is a team effort. We're thankful for the personnel, the preparation, and the leadership at the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. 10 years ago, as Dr. Hartman mentioned, they worked with the Minnesota poultry industry to develop a response plan for this type of influenza. And we also worked with the University of Minnesota to develop the business continuity plans that are now being implemented. And every couple years, the Board of Animal Health has hosted an emergency exercise that has helped us prepare to respond to the situation that we're currently in. The Board of Animal Health is the gold standard for government-industry partnership, as they repeatedly, over the last several decades, have worked with us to improve the health of our flocks. We're thankful for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and as Commissioner Fredrickson mentioned, they are both leading the incident command structure that is in place to coordinate the emergency response and those assisting with the implementation. And we are thankful to the United States Department of Agriculture's emergency response teams that work with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health to coordinate the logistics of eradicating the virus from infected farms and working with farmers to resume their farm businesses. We also appreciate USDA's efforts in keeping our trading partners informed. You had the pleasure of hearing Dr. Clifford earlier, and Dr. Clifford is the reason that we are still exporting to Mexico. The work that he's done, the trip that he took down there recently, is what made its difference. And I do want to update a comment that Commissioner Fredrickson had made, and I want to thank him and the governor's office for working with the state of Arkansas. They have lifted that ban on Minnesota product. That's a pretty major market for our breeder eggs as well as poults, and so that's been key. We're thankful for the Minnesota Department of Health in that they have a veterinarian on staff to work as a liaison with the state's health animal health agencies and to help us understand and protect human health and worker health. The Commissioner of Health has repeatedly confirmed that high path avian influenza is not a food safety issue and that the turkey is safe to eat, and he has reassured consumers of that. I'm very thankful for the University of Minnesota and its capacity to help us solve problems. Nearly 40 years ago, avian health expert Dr. Dave Halverson worked with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and the poultry industry to establish a program to test every flock of turkeys either raised or processed in Minnesota for avian influenza. That gave us a better understanding of how to prevent and eradicate milder strains of the virus. 25 years ago, Minnesota's poultry industry raised over $1 million to establish and create the Pomeroy Chair in Avian Health. This endowed chair was named for Dr. Ben Pomeroy, who built his reputation as a University of Minnesota researcher on working directly with Minnesota poultry farmers to improve flock health. And you heard from Dr. Carol Cardona, who now sits in that chair and is an internationally recognized avian influenza expert. She's been invaluable to the efforts of the state and industry to respond to this crisis. She will also be key to our future research in understanding and preventing high-path H5N2 viruses in the future. Another important segment of the university to farmers is the veterinary diagnostic lab. Getting accurate and timely diagnosis of the virus it helps farmers to lock down their farms to prevent the potential spread of the virus. The diagnostic lab will also be an important part of the research team in helping us understand this particular strain of influenza. I've been in my position for nearly 15 years, and when I started, one of my first impressions was how entrepreneurial turkey farmers are. They prefer to have their success or failure rest in their hands. To that end, they're used to managing risk. They put money away in good years to help get through the downward markets. However, high-path avian influenza and influenza is a game changer. We are moving into tornado season, and a tornado warning lets us know that there have been tornadoes spotted in our area. What we don't know is whether it will hit our home. We build basements to help protect us in the event of a tornado. We close doors and windows and go under the steps in the basement and wait, listening for the sound of a train. For poultry farmers, especially turkey growers, high-path avian influenza is like a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week tornado warning that lasts for 2 months. So what are we doing? For the past 6 weeks and for the next few weeks, growers are on constant alert, inspecting their flocks, actively looking for clinical signs of high-path avian influenza funnel cloud, checking and rechecking the methods to keep their flocks healthy, and investing in new disease prevention practices. Minnesota raises about 2,500 flocks of turkeys each year. So far, we've found 22 flocks that are positive for this virus. And while that's a small percentage, it is having a huge impact on those farmers that are directly affected and impacted. For those farms that have been infected, this is not only a financial but also an emotional impact, and that's been devastating to them as well as their workers. Their focus has always been on bird health. And watching a flock die from a virus and not being able to do anything to stop it is difficult. Even more difficult is having to euthanize healthy birds in other flocks on their farm. As I mentioned, high-path avian influenza is a game changer. USDA researchers predict that this will be with us for the next 3 to 5 years. As an association, we are looking at investing research. We're looking at making an investment in research to better understand the strain of virus, how it's transmitted, and what we can do to improve our ability to keep flocks healthy through improved management technology. We will also continue to work together with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health, the Minnesota Departments of Agriculture and Health, the USDA, and the University of Minnesota's College of Food, Ag, and Natural Resource Sciences, Veterinary Medicine, and the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. Our partnership with those entities over the past 76 years of our organization's existence has helped us become the largest turkey-producing state in the United States and is key to helping our future success. Most of our farms have been in business for several generations, and turkey growers are a resilient bunch. And together with our partners, they will not only get through this, but will continue to thrive.
Thanks, Mr. Olson. And sitting next to you is a producer from a little bit south of here, Mr. Zimmerman. Good morning. Identify yourself and what is it like out there?
I'm John Zimmerman. I'm a turkey grower from near Northfield, Minnesota in Rice County, and I serve on the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association Board and also the National Turkey Federation Board. Most everything's been covered already. I would like to thank all the people sitting behind me and all the alphabet soup acronym government entities that we work with, and also Governor Dayton. I loaded out turkeys last night, and I was very thankful that it only took me 10 semis instead of 12 because Governor Dayton allowed us to lift the road restrictions. Anything I can keep off my farm, the happier I am. I've never been more happy to get rid of a healthy flock of birds in my life. What's happening on the farm? We've always had biosecurity. As Dr. Cardona said, we've stepped it up several notches. We're now on a barn-based biosecurity instead of a farm-based biosecurity. Sleep at night has been difficult for many of us. I'm lucky that I am disease-free, but I empathize with my friends and colleagues who have had to lose a flock, and I don't want it to happen to me. So we're doing everything in our power to stop the spread of this disease.
Yeah. And, Mr. Zimmerman, unlike crop insurance for corn and soybeans, there is no crop insurance as such for livestock, correct?
There is no insurance that would cover disease loss. We have building insurance, and if our building collapses, yes, there's some coverage there, but nothing for disease loss.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Questions? We do have the DNR here. Mr. Cornicelli is going to give us an update on what they've done to track the wild birds flying through. So as he works his way after, any further questions for Mr. Representative Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zimmerman, along with your flocks of turkeys, do you do any other type of agricultural practices?
Mr. Zimmerman.
I am also a crop farmer. I was picking rock this morning.
And that
does make that much more difficult. A lot of our turkey growers are also crop producers, and we're heading into our busy season. So now we have multiple things to worry about, and it's a very stressful time, and it just adds fuel to the fire.
Representative Keel.
I can appreciate that. It makes life a little crazy, and especially when you're unable to sleep with the worries. I want to make a comment that I can't imagine how devastating it is to walk into a barn and realize that you've got a serious problem and it isn't fixable or controllable. And a very frustrating thing, and I appreciate the stress you're going under. And hope that we can do whatever is available to help you with the situation at hand.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys, both of you, for being here. I've known Mr. Olson for a number of years, former student of mine.
You're not that old, are you, Representative Fabian?
Wow. On my cell phone, my photos, I have a picture with myself and John Burkle and his family with the presidential turkey from a few years ago. So, oftentimes when these situations happen in the state and around, and there's kind of a dot on a map and all that sort of stuff, but you really put a personal face on this. And of course, some people know that this is affecting my district and a good friend of mine and his family. And you talk about the stress and the strain in agriculture, and in this case in particular, it's very, very difficult for growers. their families, their friends and neighbors, and just the anxiety that's out there is unbelievable. I've been very close to the ag community my entire life. I can remember having a phone conversation several years ago with a friend of mine. It was raining again in the morning for, I don't know, the 14th day in a row in Rosa or whatever it was, and I picked up the phone and I called Steve and I said, I don't know how you do this farming stuff, because the two things you don't have control over are the two things that determine your outcome the most, the weather and the price. So anyway, also I do want to say, too, that we went to a shameless plug here. We went to McGovern's the other night, Representative Anderson and myself, and we had turkey pot pies to eat that night. So we're continuing.
And it was good.
Yes, and we'll do it again. I need to say thank you to everybody that's been involved in this whole process. This is amazing the way different agencies and people and stuff have pulled together, all the men and women with their boots on the ground out there who are depopulating and going through all this stuff and doing the inspections and notifying neighbors and stuff. This is a great example of how government and private enterprise pulls together to try to solve a problem and head it off. And to everybody, so many people to name that it's, I'll forget someone. So in light of that, I'm just going to say thank you to everybody who's doing such great work to try to deal with this very, very difficult issue. I do have Mr. Cornicelli's coming down. I appreciate that. We've had some discussions in the Environment Committee with regards to ducks and geese, and of course where I live we kind of refer to them as skycarp, but we've got some language in our environment bill that's going to give some growers a little more leeway in being able to control things at the local level with regards to waterfowl that are going to be around their farms and ranches. And I know that there are there's a strong commitment within the agency to provide all of the freedom and the leverage that they need to be able to protect their investment. So I thank DNR for that as well. So and then I do, most people know that I'm not very techie, okay, but I do want to let everybody know that for all of you that are on Twitter, that there is a going to be this afternoon at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, a USDA APHIS conversation on Twitter about steps for producers to take on biosecurity to prevent the H5N2 avian. And this is avian flu, not Fabian flu, just so you know that. And you can access this on the hashtag ChickenChat2015. Okay. That's hashtag ChickenChat2015, Representative Franson. Thank you. Mr. Cruz.
We have a couple more questions. Thank you, Representative Fink. A couple more questions, and we want to get Mr. Cornicelli down here. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments, actually. I grew up on a turkey farm, and 40 years ago, on May 5th, 1965, our farm was hit by a tornado. And during that time, I recall having, and I was very young, but, you know, the turkeys were all over, and trying to collect turkeys and bring them back to the farm. But I can imagine, I know how stressful that was for my father at that time, but I can just exponentially understand how stressful it would be waiting for that tornado to hit and not knowing if it's going to hit. So I very much appreciate your story about how that is and how stressful that is. And I just wanted to, again, thank you to all of the responders and the people, and thank you to the producers for continuing to every day hope and pray that you're not going to be hit, and being there to support those who have been. I think it's just tremendously stressful, and I just wanted to comment as well about mental health counseling and getting some more support for that. And I spoke with Ted Matthews, who does that for the state, and he has been in contact with the Department of Ag, certainly is available to continue to be that supportive person to help in these stressful and distressful times. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Representative. Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Olson or Mr. Zimmerman, can you just walk us through some of the practices, the biosecurity practices that you and other growers are following, trying to uphold the integrity of the health of the flocks?
Representative
Mr. Zimmerman.
We've always had fairly good biosecurity, but like I said, we've stepped it up a notch. Before, we would just wash our boots. Now we're changing our boots, and I have separate boots for every employee in every barn, separate coveralls for every employee in every barn. We have always limited traffic from younger birds to older birds. We're continuing to do that. No visiting on the farm. Repairs are kind of taking a back seat right now. If we need an electrician, it's just going to have to wait until this stressful time is over. So we're continuing to do the processes we've always done. We're just doing them on a barn base instead of a farm base. In addition, the Danish method that Dr. Cardona talked about, that involves changing some of our entryways around. We are implementing that as we can in our barns. Obviously, every farm's a little different, but we're taking the advice of our colleagues and doing everything we can.
Thanks, Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you.
Mr. Cornicelli, could you come down and give us an update on your testing? Representative Bly.
Yeah, just quickly, I wanted to thank my constituent for coming today, and it was very helpful to hear your testimony. Thank you very much.
Mr. Cornicelli, we have to be out of here quickly, but we really appreciate your patience, and tell us about the work the DNR is doing to help in this effort.
My pleasure, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lou Cornicelli, I work for the Department of Natural Resources. We don't often testify about wildlife health in front of this committee, so I wanted to just let you know that we work with our state and federal partners on wildlife surveillance, educating our stakeholders, and implementing disease plans. I agree with Dr. Cardona. This is certainly an unprecedented event, and we're gearing up with respect to surveillance and detection. The good or bad news is we've certainly worked with the board on multiple occasions on disease events, so we have a pretty good track record of doing that, so we're implementing a lot of those plans. Now, to break down what we're doing actually three things at this point in time. We're currently collecting 3,000 environmental samples from waterfowl across the state, and we've broken that out into two different methods. An active surveillance program where we've selected five counties of in infected areas around those surveillance circles, and we'll try and get 1,500 samples. And then we've selected five of our major units around the state, which are managed specifically for waterfowl, and we're going to try and collect 300 samples each from those, so another 1,500 kind of as a control. So we're looking to get 3,000 samples between now and when we get done. We've submitted about 650 samples so far. We have 400 of those back, and they're all negative. We should get another 250 back today. We typically ship on Mondays and Thursdays, depending on when we get samples. So we're out there doing our environmental sampling. As Dr. Hartman said, basically that's poop collection. It's not glamorous, but it's the only way to really do it at this time of year. Second, we're putting a call out to our wild turkey hunters in some of these counties. We're going to have a news release probably coming out Monday, asking hunters in Meeker, Stearns, Candiohi, and Polk counties to give us a call, and we'll try and collect AI samples from wild turkeys. We're trying to get 300 of those. And then finally, we do have an AI response plan, so we've put the call out to look for calls of dead raptors, geese, and other species greater than five, and turkeys as well. So we're actively testing birds that get called in. We're learning a lot of birds get hit on the side of the road this time of year because we're getting a lot of calls, but so far we've only submitted about a dozen raptors. One's come back negative, the other 11 are pending. So we're certainly actively looking for the virus. This summer, we do routine duck banding every summer. We typically ban 3,000-4,000 ducks, and likely we're going to start looking at trying to find some money to do some surveillance and AI when we ban ducks. So we're out there looking, and we'll certainly report results as things become available.
Thanks, Doctor. Question, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Cornicelli, I'm going to be out turkey hunting this weekend, if we get out of here, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be out in the field turkey hunting. So as a turkey hunter and for wild turkeys, what should I do or what should my peers do when we are out in the field and if we get if we are successful in taking a wild turkey?
Good question. Doctor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, we always advocate good food handling. I defer to my colleagues at the Department of Health, but wear gloves, certainly cook your meat to 165 degrees. That kills bacteria and virus. And that's kind of the recommendations we make for anything. It really doesn't matter if we're looking at a disease event or just good food handling practices. You always want to keep yourself clean, wear gloves if you can, and then cook it properly.
Representative Hanson.
And then, Mr. Chair, do you have the number that we should call if we found if we'd find dead birds, or is that on the DNR website, or?
Doctor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, you put me on the spot. If you go to mndnr.gov, our number will be there. It's a 188 number, and I know it ends 6367. I can't remember the middle three. But all of our regulations book have our number on it, and I can certainly get that number to the committee. For some reason, I'm blanking on the prefix.
Last question, Chair Hamlin.
Thank you. To the testifier, we did hear some testimony from some producers who have outdoor flocks. And we just want to be sure that the department is doing education to game wardens and stuff like that, so that they too are following biosecurity protocols as they visit these farms. We did hear one example where the game warden and the farmer were having a little bit of disagreement on the biosecurity protocols that must be followed when they're doing this surveillance as well. So if we can educate everybody that's involved, it'd be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Chair, yes, we have been trying to do that. You know, this is evolving by the minute, as folks have said, and we've gotten word out to our staff that they're to avoid going on these locations because they are biosecurity protocols in place. So we're doing our best to do that. And we have been working with law enforcement and our area staff, and as Representative Fabian said, it's currently legal to haze geese for, non-lethally haze geese for different reasons, and we've been talking about adding disease to that. So we're working through it just like everybody else is. So that's good advice, and we are trying to do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Mr. Cornelius. I have a phone number here. I think the one you were looking at, 651-296-5484.
That's our local number. We have an 888 as well.
888-646-6367.
Couldn't remember the 646. Okay. Correct.
888-646-6367. You are techie, Representative. Again, thanks to all of our testifiers.
Thank
excellent
you.
Information. Great job you're doing. Thanks to the folks attending. Meeting's adjourned.